Tonight, I have the opportunity to introduce someone I've known for approximately 2 or 3 years. I think I met him when he first came in. His sponsor was one of the first few people who was involved with the 164 group on Tuesday nights. He became a good friend of mine. And I've watched him grow, and he grows and he grows. And it's just and spiritual growth is what I'm talking about. He's not the type that jumps out and demands attention, but when you look at the things, and when things are done, he's usually there and has had a hand in it. All you have to do is ask him for a simple bit of help. Sometimes you don't even need to ask, and he's there. He's a true embodiment of the steps, and it's with great pleasure I get to introduce my friend Larry B.
Thanks for coming, everybody. My name is Larry, and I am a grateful recovered alcoholic.
Hey, Larry.
I have recovered from a hopeless state of mind and body, which my story will prove to be the case. I need to go way back to the beginning. As I've went through the steps with my sponsor, I found that my problem wasn't alcohol. It was driven by 100 forms of fear. That was what started the ball on the way it started rolling. I was the first child of six, born in Atlanta, Georgia, in 1951. I moved with my mother to my grandmother and grandfather's house in Bowdoin, Georgia, which is close to the Alabama border. My father was overseas in the Korean conflict, they called it, and I was raised happy, joyous, and free for the first 5 years on a little farm in Bowdoin, Georgia. I had two mothers, Big Mama and Little Mama, and Papa. And I have nothing but good memories, not a lot of them because I was pretty little, of an idyllic life, running around the yard with a straw hat and short pants on, barefoot. My mother chasing me with a hickory switch, or my grandmother. They told me I was a good kid, but they were chasing me with a switch anyway. And I think it was just a thing they did in the South, whether you needed it or not. But I used to go down to downtown with Papa. Papa had a barbershop. He had a barbershop with a pole on it and everything. And at one point, he had a shoe shop too, a shoe repair shop. And this was a little, little small town. And I don't remember a whole lot. My father, like I said, was in Korea. And I think when he came back, I was still only like two or something like that. So I don't remember him at all. And then he promptly went to occupied Germany, which the military made a huge base in Europe after they got rid of Hitler and everything. And so he was gone the first 5 years. And I had two mothers and a loving grandfather. And I remember going to school there, so I must have been five or six, and I talked a lot, and so they put me in the front of the class, and but I got good grades anyway. And then one day, this really big dude comes in with a uniform on, and it's my father, and I mean he's 6'3", and I was like 4-0, or 3-0. So this is a really big guy, and I didn't even know who he was, but I figured since my mom liked him, we'd better go along with the deal. And so we proceeded to move from this incredible warm surrounding to a military life. I had one sister old enough to walk, and another one she was pretty little, and we moved to from the country in Georgia to Fort Hood, Texas, and in a little bitty car. He always bought real cheap cars. We had a Renault. It was the little teeny teeny one, and so there were five of us in this car. Fortunately, three of us weren't very big. And I remember Texas wasn't too bad, you know. It rained a lot, and it was hot and muggy, but so was Georgia. And school was the same, you know, pretty much. I don't know when I was able to get this this chameleon thing going on so early in my life. I could change. Any time that we moved, I would be able to go and talk to people and make friends and stuff. It's like no big deal. And so, but the really key event that happened in Texas was the onset of a fear that I would have the rest of my life until I did the steps. My father pulled me aside when we were, I don't know, some months after we'd moved there, to ask me what I did when he was gone. And he said, you know, did your mother have friends? I said, she had lots of friends. did she have any men friends? I said, she had lots of friends. And that didn't go over really big with him. I don't know when, but beatings started immediately after that conversation I had with him. And it wasn't just my mother. It was all of us kids, too. And I didn't know why. But I knew I had to learn how to duck really fast because whenever he started these beatings, he was sitting there drinking. And, you know, I know now that he was just a sick person. I didn't know he wasn't just mean. I thought he was just really mean. But who is this guy? How could my mother love him? And why is this happening to me? And so school was the escape. You know, when I went to school every day, that was great because I didn't have to be at home. And I thought I didn't know if these beatings are going to last forever, but they did. there was always one more night of him, you know, coming home, not being in a bad mood, and then sitting down drinking, and we would go through several hours of this drinking episode and having to listen to him rant and rave about whatever. I couldn't remember. And then going to bed and waking up in the morning, and hopefully, you know, he was already gone, and I would go to school. But then in the evening, there was this fear of being at home. I was hoping that the next move was going to change things, you know, because we moved from Fort Hood, Texas to Orléans, France. And we drove back across to Atlanta to say goodbye to my grandparents. And which was the last time I'd ever see them. In another little bitty foreign car. I think it was a Fiat at the time. He didn't buy a Volkswagen Bug. We should have had a Bug. They ran forever. But anyway, he wasn't very smart. But I'll never forget saying goodbye to the grandparents and they're, you know, just crying and everything. And I had a little tissue wadded up my hand, and we had to get on a plane. I'd never been on a plane before, and flying out of Atlanta was pretty big even back then. They had jets. This jet we got on was brand new, sparkling jet with the sparkling stewardesses, and everything was sparkling, perfect, you know. And we even had facing seats in the plane and stuff like that. There was lots of room around, and I'll never forget that, how sparkling that plane was, and I was excited. This was cool. Oh, my father wasn't with us. He had to go, and it was fun. he had to go all over to Germany and or France to set up, you know, home and stuff. And so we flew from Atlanta to New York. And then we got on a military, this was on a private plane, a commercial plane. And then we got a military flight from New York to Paris. Well, the jet thing was really neat, but the military plane was not. It took 14 hours in an egg beater. It just had four big propeller things on it. And it was dark and not clean. And, you know, it was like, oh, this is no good. And we flew to Greenland, and then we flew to London, and then we flew to Paris, and it took forever. We get to Paris, and of course it's cold and wet, and kind of cold and dark and wet. And he found a place for us 60 miles south of Paris, next to the base, where he would be stationed for 3.5 more years. And I'd never been to a Department of Defense school before. Was Texas a DOD? Nah, I don't remember. Anyway, it's not important. But in Europe, the military bases had everything. They had, you know, food commissaries. They had buses that take you everywhere. They had movie houses. They had everything that you would have in America except TV. And they didn't have military TV stations. I don't know why. They could have. But anyway, so here we are, brand new place. It didn't change. The beatings didn't stop. There was still this unknown reason that he had a problem with my mother and her children. There were four of us by then. My first little brother was born in Texas. We dragged him with us. There were six of us in that little car to Atlanta, and then he took off. My father took off. But let's see. France was that'd be second, third, fourth, fifth. It would be third, fourth, fifth, and sixth grades. Went to one school the whole time because it was a large school, and they would bus us from wherever we were. We lived on the base part of the time, but most of the time we lived out on the French economy because it was cheaper. You could get a place there for like $30 a month, you know, for a house. And the neat thing about that was there was French people living next door. It was really cool. So I got to go play with French kids, and we played cars, and I spoke broken French, and they spoke broken English, and we got along great. And I got to watch Bonanza on TV with French subtitles. It was really funny to see Haas with this mousy little blah, 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 you know, French thing coming out. And it was fun to eat popcorn with sugar on it. That's what they liked, it with sugar on it. So some pretty good memories of being in France. We had Little League, and I remember having to get on the big green military bus and ride way out in the country, and we'd have our little League park out there, and I had a uniform and everything, and I was still too small to be any kind of a baseball player, but I showed up anyway because I had to get away from the house. And school was good. Picked up a lot of French. Don't have a lot left over because I don't use it. But the alcohol still continued. And by this point, you know, we had to bring the alcohol into the house for him and stuff. And he told us if we dropped it that he would kill us. And I was starting to believe that he would. I had a lot of fear about that. And at this point, he's starting to, because I'm his number one son. I'm also have rank in the family because I'm the oldest and I'm boy. So I didn't have an actual title. I wasn't a sergeant or anything. but I was responsible for the outcome of keeping the house together and the behavior of the other kids. And if any they got into trouble, it was my ass that got beat. Well, we got beat anyway, but I got beat again, twice or something. And sometime during that period, there was a glass of vodka that he miraculously didn't finish, and I took a drink of it because I had to figure out what is this stuff, you know, that's making him crazy. And I took a sip and just this is not going to work at all. And one of my sisters took a sip, same thing. We're not going to drink this stuff ever. So we didn't. I've never wanted to have a drink of alcohol, nor did I ever want to be like my father. He did want me to be in Little League, and he wanted me to make good grades in school. But he said, because you're small, you're going to have to fight the rest of your life because you're small, and people are going to pick on you. And so I'm going to teach you how to defend yourself. So around and during the beatings and stuff, I was taught martial arts by this hulking drunk brute. And he would come after me, and I would have to dodge and duck, and I would have to grab him and throw him on the floor. Well, I didn't really want to throw him on the floor because I'd really get it. So, but he taught me well. I was actually, you know, countering his blows and stuff like that because we were sparring and whatever. One time I did throw him across the room, though. And I was a little teeny guy. But he was also really drunk. And I thought it was going to be bad from that, but it was okay. But there were hours when he would come home that we'd have to listen to this stuff that he would just spew out of his mouth. And I remember sitting there, I couldn't look at him in the eyes. He had a tattoo on his arm that was all kind of muddy from, it was probably a bad job. And I decided I didn't like alcohol and I didn't like tattoos. Because that was what I had to deal with every day, or just about every day. And I remember having a girlfriend, my first girlfriend in France. Her name was Veronica, and she was really nice. And she lived down the road. Her parents were French, and she was going to the American school. And they didn't have all this chaos at their house. You know, it's like, I kind of thought, I was beginning to think that everybody had these problems at their house, but it was just us. And it was really nice going over to their house because they would sit down at the table and eat and enjoy their meals. And we didn't do that at our house. And so living in France for 4 years, Europe, if you've been there, you'll know it is a different world. I mean, the buildings are different, the streets. It's amazing to walk down a street that's over 2,000 years old. The cathedrals and the chateaus and all that stuff. It was like I was growing up in another country. And when his tour of duty was up in France, we moved from there to Fort Bragg, North Carolina. Big change. And when we were gone, America changed. This was back in the 50s. And America got big. America got big TV, and America got big, huge signs, and American cars were bigger and longer and more chrome on them. And in France, there's no chrome on anything, and it's all kind of like, you know, different. It's really different. So it was really neat being in another world and coming back, and I didn't really like it here as much. I didn't. Everybody had said, well, it was mainly the British, that the French were snobs, but I thought they were nice people, you know. And anyway, so Fort Bragg, North Carolina. Fort Bragg is like a city. It's an enormous military base. And we lived, again, on the base and off the base. And right around now, man, I'm getting up there in age. I'm in middle school, what they used to call junior high school. Yeah, I'm in junior high at that point. And I did have my encounter with a bully. All the bullies that my father warned me about never showed up in my life, but one guy did. And he was like the high school jock ultimate. You know, he was the basketball guy, the football guy, and he did everything, you know, and he had a group that traveled with him and everything. And he used to pop me upside the head in the hallway. And I didn't want a confrontation because it was too many guys, you know. But one day I just got really tired of it and turned around and said, "Bobby, why do you do that?" You know, and that's all I had to do was just turn around and talk to him. And not only did he stop, but nobody else could mess with me either because I made a friend, you know, just by showing up, you know, and talking to him instead of running or being scared. Anyway, but I couldn't run from my family. I had to go home there every day. But like I said, school was my way of coping with life. I kept making good grades. Still talked a lot in class. That's the only marks I would get would be I talked too much. I used to tell a lot of jokes. this is about the time too that I had to start lying. We had bruises on us from getting bashed. I mean, he would, first of all, it was just a couple of belt marks on your butt, bare ass, and then it was face bruises and stuff like that, and black eyes, and so we'd have to lie because he said if we told anybody what happened, he would kill us. My mother had gone to his company commander a couple of times, and he threatened her. My father threatened her also. "If you do that again, I'll kill you." Divorce wasn't something that in the South, you know, nobody talked about divorce. You stuck with your spouse forever. You know, that was it. You just went through it. And so my mother didn't know that divorce would have been an option, and I didn't know there was any escape. You know, this guy was going to be around, and I was going to keep going to school, and that's just the way it is. And it didn't stop with just the big kids. He would beat up the little ones too, and they were so little. I couldn't believe that. And my mother. So. It was in North Carolina he had his first DTs. I didn't know that the alcohol made him sick. But one day, it was early. We didn't have the sit-down blah, 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 blah thing going on. He was acting really strange, and he fell down on the floor and started shaking really bad. So you know, I guess he went into a seizure, and they took him to the hospital. And I went, "Whoa. What a blessing." I mean, I didn't say that, but I had some relief that he was maybe gonna get taken care of. Maybe he was gonna get better. And they let him out of the hospital. And my mother had talked to his commander again about his drinking problem, and he did the same thing. His company commander said, "Well, just son, you're going to have to stop doing that kind of thing, you know, take care of your family. Don't do it again." And I don't think alcoholism was, the military didn't have a policy with it back then. They do now. They have treatment programs and all kinds of stuff because it has been a problem for decades in the military. This was now, we had six kids by this point, and to mention that. Oh, he got reassigned for 1 year, a 1 year stay in Thailand when we were in North Carolina. And that was the best year we ever had at the family. Just was hoping he would never come back. Everybody got along great. We all still had the same roles. I mean, I was still in charge of keeping the house and stuff like that. One good thing is I learned how to cook and clean like you won't believe when I was in charge of the house. I didn't get a lot of extracurricular activities in. I didn't do any sports. Just, you know, went to school and went home and took care of this stuff. And but while he was gone, my mother tried to teach me how to drive. That did not work. I didn't have any clue about how to drive. We had a 59 Plymouth station wagon, the one with the big fins. Things as long as this room, you know. And I couldn't, it was 8 feet wide too, and I couldn't drive it. And we had a stick. Couldn't do it. But anyway, that was a fond memory. It was Earlshy blue. It was that blue color. Big blue thing. We had to move again. The 4 years were up in North Carolina. We had to go to Fort Dix, New Jersey. And Fort Dix was, I was like in 10th grade at this point. And we got a place off the base. We didn't live on the base there at all. And it was in a town called Pemberton. This is around South Jersey, I guess. And Pemberton is this little bitty town that everybody that lived there was born there, and they went to school there, and they worked there. And so when I came in to this high school from North Carolina with 4 years of Southern in my voice and dressing completely different than the people in New Jersey did, I had arrived. I met people right away, had friends, got a girlfriend, went to the school dances and stuff they had. It was a lot of fun. And that was the year that I went, I think it was three different high schools. Or was it the next year? 1 year, we moved twice where we were, and then we moved to another location. So I went to three different high schools 1 year. And it was either the 10th or the 11th grade. I could remember if I thought about it. But it didn't matter. I was a chameleon. I could move around, and it was just part of what I learned how to do. I don't know where I got it. But I could pick up and move, because I guess I had to. So we went. We were only in New Jersey for like a little less than 2 years, and we went to Frankfurt, Germany from there. And that was when Larry started having a beer with his friends after school. In Germany, you can drink beer at any age, I think. And they have pubs. Well, they call them Gasthaus in Germany. There's like a pub. It's like, the man and his wife run it, and they have really good food, and they have really good beer. And my friends were having a glass of beer, and so I would have a glass of beer to be social and stuff. And sure as hell, after doing this for a little while, I came home one night, and I was kind of staggering down the hallway. My mother was up, standing at the end of the hallway, and she was crying. And she said, "I really had hoped that, you wouldn't turn out like your father." And I said, "There's no way I'm going to turn out like my father. I promise I'll never do it. I'll never do that." And she goes, "Well, just be careful. Just be careful." I said, okay, Mom, I'll be careful." And I was. I still went out with my friends, and I would have a beer once in a while, but I wasn't having, you know, the three or four that I did that night that I was bouncing off the walls. And the tour of duty in Germany was going to be for 3 years, and since I was a junior in high school at this point, I was only there for about a year and a half, like half of my junior year. The junior year was probably when I went to three high schools. It was New Jersey and then, New Jersey and then two in Germany. The first place we went in Germany was actually South Germany, and I commuted to Nuremberg 100 kilometers and got to stay in a dorm all week, which was really cool. And that was kind of when I started liking the beer. It tasted really good, too. That was the nice thing about German beer. And I was, you know, away from the house. Nobody would know what I did, I guess. So, but I did have that warning from my mother, which I really wanted to heed, because I did not want to turn out like my father. My father had told me when I was 13 years old that when I was 18 years old that I was out of the house, that I was gone. Under any circumstances, I would be gone. So I was ready to go emotionally, physically. My bags were packed a week before my 18th birthday, which happened June 4th, 1969. When I graduated from high school, I moved away from home. And I made a vow to myself at that point that no one was ever going to tell me what to do again. Period. And while I was in Frankfurt at one of these little pubs, I met a guy from Los Angeles who was a student at Pepperdine University, and while talking about the meaning of life and other philosophical things, he mentioned that, where are you going to go to school? And I said, well, I don't know yet. I had a scholarship to, it was like a $1,000 scholarship or something. He said, well, my folks live in L.A. If you want to come to L.A. and stay with us, you know, you could. There's a lot of incredible universities in Los Angeles. I went, sure, never been there. I'll go. And it was 8,000 miles from my family. Yes. So I had one free flight left. I got on a military flight, flew from Frankfurt to New York for free, and then from New York to Los Angeles. I was $72. Student standby. And here I go to L.A. with, and I know one person, and there's 15 million or 20. I don't know. There's a lot of people in L.A. And I had worked, because of the military education, the Department of Defense kept all of us dependents up in curriculum so that whenever we moved from place to place, we wouldn't be behind and stuff. So I had so many credits in my senior year that I didn't have to go to actual classes. I went to work. They call it work study. So I made like a handful of money. Back then, $600 was a lot of money. And that was enough to go to L.A. That was plenty to go to L.A. with. And so I had my two bags and $600 and moved to Los Angeles to go to school. My friend showed me, he took me on about a half a day tour of Los Angeles at 85 miles an hour on the freeways. Saw the whole thing, you know, from Anaheim up to Malibu and, you know, up against the mountains and past Pasadena. And I really like Santa Monica. And so I said, I want to go to school here. Is there a school here? Sure. It was Santa Monica College. It's only a junior college, but so I started Santa Monica College. But I knew I had to work, so I got a job at the Beverly Hills branch of Home Savings and Loan as a bank teller. I really liked talking to people, and they had this computer that was this big that had a keyboard on it, and they taught me how to do it, and so I figured out how to do it, and I was a bank teller. I didn't know anything about that, you know, but it was so I went to I worked full time and went to school full time. Went to school at night, took 12 and a half units, 3 hour classes, 4 nights a week. But I was young, I could do that, no problem. But I'm boring you with this because this was the first time that alcohol came into my life big. I have to mention drugs a couple of times because it was part of my aversion from alcohol. What they introduced me to marijuana, and I thought this was the solution. It's not alcohol. I'm not in pain. I feel really good, so I don't need booze. But we had this. They transferred me from Beverly Hills, which is amazing. These marble columns, I mean, it's just like the movies. There's movie stars in the lobby and all that stuff, just like the movies. But they transferred me to Santa Monica because that's really where I wanted to go, because that's where I was living and going to school. And they had a grand opening party, and all the teller windows were bars, and it was all free. And I didn't know I liked scotch at all. And so I was drinking scotch like it was beer. And one of my coworkers had to drive me home. That had never happened before. And it didn't dawn on me that I would have a problem with alcohol because I didn't drink. You know, I smoked pot. When I went to parties down at the beach, there were kegs and there were things like that, but I was out, you know, smoking pot. You know, that's what I did. And I'd have, you know, a beer once in a while, something like that. But I'll never forget that party. Somebody actually had to take me home because I couldn't. I had a little motorcycle, and they said, "No, you can't ride that thing. you have to go home." And I had my suit on, and it was right after work and everything, and I hadn't eaten dinner. You know, and I drank probably 10 scotches. No problem. And I liked the way it made me feel. And so the school also had a Tuesdays and Thursdays they had outdoor concerts out on this real grassy little amphitheater, and they had top name rock shows or rock bands there, and everybody would skip class and go smoke pot and watch the show. And so I did that a lot. But I still pulled down a decent set of grades. I was making C's and B's. I wasn't making A's anymore because I had too much going on. The major event that happened in the cafeteria outside, this lady picked me up. She wanted to go to Mexico for spring break, and she didn't have anybody to go with, and she asked me if I'd go. And I said, "No problem, I'll go, I'll do anything." And so I spent the next 7 years with her, the first, you know, real love of my life. She didn't drink, and neither did I, really. I mean, I just had that binge and other little thing, you know, in Germany a little bit, and I was just a pothead. And shortly after we got together, she was very, very artistic, and she came up with this way of making these water cast candles that glowed when you lit the candle inside of them and stuff. And to the point where she went to a craft show, which are back in those days, this was in the 70s, they had a lot of craft shows, especially in California. And she went to a craft show with her little, you know, fold-up table and a chair and stuff, and sold all of her candles. And she said, this is happening. She, you know, she made $100 in one day. That was big money back then. And so we're looking at this, and she goes, you know, this is something we should do together. So I started making candles with her in the bathtub in the place that she had down on the beach. And so we started cranking out all these candles, and we went to shows, and all the people that did the craft shows were really fun to party with and smoke pot with and stuff. And so we were, you know, this looks like a really good thing to do. And at this point, I'm getting tired of going to school. I'm getting tired of working. And I wanted to, nobody was going to tell me what to do anymore. And so let's just stop and you know, go sell candles. She had a really good job as a governess for an extremely wealthy family in Bel Air. And so we shucked everything and jumped in her 62 Volkswagen window van, which she had put 6 engines in it because she didn't know how to put oil and stuff in the engine. But God was looking after her. You know, she met auto mechanics that would give her an engine without asking her for anything else. And so we hit the road, and I grew my hair long, bought a guitar. That was, you know, I had to do my hippie thing. And we were traveling on the road out of her van, making and selling candles all over California. In between the shows, we would go to Yosemite and San Francisco and Mount Shasta and Oregon and down in the desert, you know, in Death Valley and stuff. And we were all, and all the people that went to these craft shows did the same thing. They all traveled and went to the shows. And they all were incredible craftsmen and incredible alcoholics. And so while partying with them, I found out that I really did like to drink and smoke pot. And I'll never forget the first fierce hangover I had from tequila. It was in the desert. It hurt for like 3 days. My head was so... It hurt so bad. Must have drank a lot of it. But anyway, there's a whole lot I'm going to leave out. Let's see, how much time I got?
It's 8:22.
Oh, no.
Well, you take your time.
Okay, here we go. What I'm going to do is I'm going to fast forward. Oh, I forgot my whole marriage. I was married for 16 years.
Same woman?
No, well, okay, Marla was the 7-year incredible artist, and she just took care of me. I didn't want to take care of anybody anymore, and she took care of me. She was a fantastic cook. She had all the drive to get us out to all these places and do incredible stuff. And but she had an affair in San Diego, and I had one in San Francisco, and that shot that. And then I met at the hip wedding on Mount Tamalpais in Marin County. You know, there was a teepee and the long dresses and the flowers in the hair and stuff. Well, I met the bridesmaid was my wife of the future, and I met her there, and you know, we made love in the hot tub and all that stuff. And we weren't married for the first 6 years, but we lived together. And you know, my drinking was steady. It was just kind of steady. I was drinking every day, but not, you know, in the morning, not at noon, you know, not at noon or anything. But I was drinking every day. We had major events. We had a lot of friends. She was in the music business, and I was a carpenter, did remodeling. And all my friends drank, and all of her friends were in the music business drank. And so we'd have these giant parties with jam sessions and stuff, and everybody drank. And any excuse to have an event, you know, whether it be New Year's, Valentine's Day, just count them. Any anything, Halloween, you name it, we always had a big, huge party. We had, you know, lots of really good food and lots of good booze, too. I was making really good money. I was buying $100 bottles of champagne, Coke, as much Coke as I wanted. Just steadily progressing, but managing the whole thing. I had the beautiful wife, all the tools that I wanted. I had a boat, jet ski, motorcycles. We went on vacations to Hawaii. I did everything I wanted to do. I was free. And nobody was ever telling me what to do ever again. And my wife started going to Al-Anon, and I didn't know it. And she started leaving those little brochures around the house. You know, can you answer these 7 questions? Well, I threw them all away for a long time, you know. And then finally I read one. And sure enough, yes to all 7 questions. I went, well, this isn't good, you know, because I knew she was my at that point, my friends that I drank with are starting to come up and ask me, why do I drink so much? Why am I the last one to go at the end of the night, you know? And so I started thinking about it. My sister, one of my sisters, did the same thing. And everybody else was drinking. You know, I was just drinking a little too much. So I'll have to slow down. But I never really did. I couldn't lose my job because I was self-employed. But I could lose my wife. And one day she said that, you know, you're going to have to make a choice. It's either me or alcohol. And I said, well, you know, it's just going to have to be, I guess it's the end of us. Because, you know, nobody's going to tell me what to do. I didn't say that. I don't remember what I said. I was drunk. And she left. And fortunately, we had no children and no belongings, just, you know, a few toys here and there and stuff like that. So divorce was real easy. But I knew something was wrong. And about 6 months or so after the we split up, I'm living in the house that we had shared for almost all 16 years by myself, and the loneliness started, you know, setting in, you know, because pretty much, you know, hearing this stuff from my friends and the fact that now all of our friends had made choices about who they were going to hang out with and not, you know, no, the phone wasn't ringing anymore. Alcohol was, you know, going to shut everything down, and I didn't really know it. And the only thing that was going to make that better was just to continue to drink. And I'm going to figure out a way to get from there to... Oh, got to throw the DUI in there. I had only one DUI out of almost 40 years of drinking, which is amazing because I went across the Golden Gate Bridge with a beer between my legs every day to work for 2.5-3 years when I worked in San Francisco. They have cameras on the bridge. And so I got my DUI 0.26. And my sister had started, in order for her to deal with her childhood, she became a doctor of psychology. there was also sexual molestation by my father also. I forgot to mention that. All three sisters. And she was studying alcohol and drug abuse at the time, and she said, Larry, you're in trouble. You got to take care of this, blah, blah, blah. Here's what you do. So I had to go to meetings. I had to go to an outpatient, you know, group and all this stuff. And blah, blah, blah. I was doing all this and going to meetings and drinking between meetings and, you know, no license, no credit card. I had to go bankrupt because I all this while I was partying, I just spent credit card things like crazy. And when I stopped working, there was no way to pay the bills. I wasn't on the bottom yet. I still had the ability to work. I wasn't drinking all day, and all night, but most of the night. Wait a minute. Let's see. You've got to go from. I realized I'd better get a real job. That's what it was. So I went to work for a juvenile treatment center for adolescents for 10 years, and they hired me in spite of the DUI. And I thought, since I was in a place of recovery, that something might rub off, because I knew I was kind of in trouble. And 5 years after I started there, they smelled alcohol on me to the point where they said that you're going to have to go to a rehab or you're going to lose your job. So I did a 30-day rehab to keep my job, and came out in recovery. But I was drinking again, two or three days after the rehab. And not telling anybody, of course. 5 more years went by. I got fired from that job. And during the 10 years, I had a retirement of like $30,000 that had accrued. And so I took that $30,000, and for the next 2 years, I drank. Because I was done with work. I was lonely. I pretty much lost my spirit. I had a couple clients I could call and go get a little work here and there, but I was not motivated. I didn't have any spirit. So I pretty much holed up in my little house. I had to sell my motorcycle, which was the last prized possession, because I was too shaky to ride it. My feet had started going numb from the alcohol, and I was too hungover to handle this monstrous bike I had. Used to be a lot of fun riding those roads, but so I was running out of steam, and I got to the really serious stage of alcoholism where I didn't know what time of the day it was. There were receptacles around so I could throw up wherever I was in the house. There was debris scattered throughout. I couldn't shower. I was afraid of falling down the tub. I couldn't shave because I was shaking too bad. It took me 3 days to write my rent check, which I had money for to write the rent, but I couldn't write the check because I was shaking too bad. And right about then, when my feet got so bad I couldn't go to the mailbox anymore, somehow I got enough energy to go to the emergency room and asked the doctor, say, "Doc, my feet are really, they're bothering me. I can't feel them. I can't walk very good." And he put me on an IV and gave me a nice 2-hour nap. And then when I woke up, he said, "If you keep doing what you're doing, Mr. Boone, you're going to be dead in about 3 months." And I was in a fog. I was like, hungover or drunk or something. And I heard what he said, and all it did was slow me down a little bit. But God works in miracles. So my parents just happened to drop down unexpectedly to visit. And I hadn't seen them for a couple of years. They lived up in Redding, California, and I was in Petaluma. And knocked on the door, and I opened the door, and I saw him there, and I went, "I can't see you guys right now," and I closed the door on them. I didn't want to let them in the house. They couldn't see me like that. And they left, and then an hour later they came back, and they said, "We're going to be moving to Tennessee, and you can come with us. It's okay if you say no, but it's better that you don't." And I said, "Okay," because I was too weak to say no. They liquidated my house, And I don't know if I had alcohol in the house. I didn't know what time of day it was. I was sleeping at night, I thought, and when I'd wake up, it would be daytime. And then I would wake up every few hours to drink so I wouldn't feel bad when I woke up again. I mean, it was really bad. It was really bad. I'd shriveled down to nothing. I was about 120 pounds. There was no food in the fridge. Whatever was in there was all molded. My parents cleaned the whole house up for me. Packed up my belongings, a lot of them. I have a lot of tools. I can build houses with what I have. And they packed up my tools, put my little Toyota truck behind their motorhome, and dragged me all the way to Tennessee. staying sober with them, nurturing me back to help, they left the drive shaft out of my truck so that I couldn't drive it, because they had to do that to tow it. And so I didn't have any alcohol for like 4 months. But the obsession didn't go away. I still wanted to drink. And even after I almost died, I had hallucinations in the motorhome. There's weirdest things. I didn't have DTs. But I had hallucinations all day and all night. In the middle of the daytime, with eyes wide open, I was seeing things. But as soon as they put the drive shaft back on the truck, I got to go downtown and look for a job. I got to get to work. My feet were starting to feel better. They were nursing me back to health. All they had was beer and wine in this little town, which is 15 miles from their house. So I drove another 15 to the town that had alcohol, booze, because I couldn't drink beer. It wasn't enough. So I was driving 60 miles one way to get a bottle of brandy. And I would drink it before I got back home. I lied to them as much as I could, but I was controlling it as much as I could. I wasn't in late stage again already, but I knew it was going to be bad. But I knew I couldn't quit. And my youngest sister lives in Florida. She calls me up and says, "There's lots of work down here. You ought to come down." I said, "Oh, what a good idea! I can go down there and get some work, and I can drink. It won't matter because she's an alcoholic." So. Came down here, did the same exact thing that I'd done before, had everything under control, got a job, started drinking before work, during work, after work. My other sister told me about the program at the Salvation Army, and she said, you know, my son, it was the only place he could ever get help, and he'd been to 18 rehabs from, he's a crackhead. And, so we're crackheads. So, I had to come to Tampa to get sober. And I could go on, I knew I should have condensed that down. The solution is incredible. What has happened in the last 3 years, I could go on for a whole hour. I got a sponsor as soon as I got into the Salvation Army. I had a spiritual experience sitting outside at a sunrise meeting there before I had my sponsor, because I'd been to church, and they were talking about God. And when I walked in those doors, I had no God in my life. I was in fear of the past, in fear of the future, and 58 years old. And so I had to listen to what they were going to tell me how to do this. And I started going to AA meetings in the dark, and came to believe that a power greater than myself was real, and he had me right where he wanted me. And this overwhelming sense of well-being came over me at that moment. I was reborn. before I did the steps. I met my sponsor about 2 weeks later. He said, as soon as you're off restriction, we're going to get you some meetings. He brought me here. He brought me to other book studies and speaker meetings. He said, don't bother with the discussion meetings right now. Just stay in the book. The book has all the answers. At this meeting, I picked up a chip every month for all 11 and brought them all back in here and plopped them down and traded it in for a one-year medallion here. And this meeting and this book, well, and a conscious contact with God. I read in here, and you guys showed me the way to the power. I had no idea. I sponsor guys at Salvation Army. It's great. There's 140 of them that all need help. I can only do them one at a time. I had to realize that. And I can only pass on what was freely given to me if I have it. And by the grace of God, my last drink was September 28th, 2009. And that is a miracle. For this alcoholic to be able to outgrow fear. When I found out what the problem was, it was so simple to fix it. When I was 5 years old, there was a spiritual void that was this big. And it grew and grew and grew and grew and got bigger to the point where it totally encompassed me. I didn't have anything else. There was no God in my life. There was only fear. And I did the chameleon thing, I guess, to overcome it. Bouncing around all over the planet. Anyway, 20 years ago, when I got my DUI, I had to go to the rooms, and I looked at all this stuff, and I went, well, you know, but I wasn't ready. I still thought that I could do it because our society or, you know, and philosophy of saying that we're the masters of our own destiny and all that stuff, and science and all that was still flying around, you know, that we can control this, that we're in control, and I never had any control. And not knowing that I don't need control, you know, this is the best thing that's ever happened. having less is more. Being part of the solution is astounding. And it's so easy to do it every day. I'm not my own way anymore. I can look in the mirror and you know, be happy in my own skin. I was crying all those years looking in the mirror. I couldn't do it. It was really awful. And that void got bigger and bigger and bigger. So, I hope that didn't bore you too much with all that. Bumping around, but this program works. I can't tell you enough how easy it was. I mean, it's silly how easy it is. All you have to do is surrender. Just give it up. not the drinking. Just give up the old life, and it tells you how to do it right here. It's real, real clear cut. And studying the book with you people, it's the best thing I've ever done. And being able to have him be with me every day, all the way through the day. when he's not there, it's because Larry's being bad. I'm not perfect. I take my will back and want my own way. So I guess we all do. but instantly, I feel the hair on my neck go up when something goes wrong, and I have to give it back. Thy will not mine, thy will not mine, thy will not mine. So, thanks for letting me share. Larry B.